Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now former Democratic National Committee Chair Donna Brazile. Her book, Making Lots of Waves Inside the Party, is called Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. You've heard how it has renewed talk of the primaries being rigged for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders, and how the Clinton campaign failed itself in the general election, despite Brazile and lots of other insiders warning them about their strategy. So, Donna, thanks for making this one of your stops. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to hear your voice again. I listen to you all the time, even when I'm not in the vicinity. So thanks for having me back on.
I'm so glad to hear that, Donna. And let's clarify first, before we get to the good news about yesterday's election, you're saying that you went looking to see if the primaries were rigged, and you determined that they were not, but what you found broke your heart. Can you unconfuse our listeners about that?
In the book, it's actually chapter 10, and the title of this chapter is Bernie, I Found the Cancer, But I Won't Kill the Patient. As you well know, I've been a Democratic operative for about 40 years of my life, and I promised Bernie when I took the position of interim chair of the DNC that I would get to the bottom of whether or not Hillary's team had rigged the party process in her favor so that only she could win the nomination. I'm reading directly from my book. I went on to say that I had tried to search out any other evidence of internal corruption that would show that the DNC was rigging the system to throw the primary to Hillary. But I could not find any in the party affairs or among the staff. I had gone department by department investigating individual conduct for evidence of skewed decisions, and I was happy to see that I had found none. Then I found this agreement. So what I tried to explain, and sometimes we don't always spell it out like ABC, but it was to essentially say that it wasn't the joint fundraising agreement, a standard agreement that many other candidates in the past, John Kerry in 2004 when he became the nominee, Barack Obama when he became the nominee in 2008. Back when I was Al Gore's campaign manager, we didn't have these form of agreements. This was post-McCain-Feingold and campaign finance reform. And so what I found was an additional agreement that was not the standard joint fundraising agreement that gave the Clinton campaign control over basically three different functions of the Democratic Party, the communications function, the technology function, and the research function, in exchange for helping us get out of a massive amount of debt, which we did have after the 2012 campaign and 2014 campaign. The Hillary Clinton campaign put us on what I call a starvation diet. Now, they have every right, as I said, while it wasn't illegal, it was in my judgment, it was unacceptable. It prevented me from doing my job as chair of the party. I called it a cancer, and the control of the Clinton camp had over the DNC made it difficult to do my job as chair. So I hope that clarifies that I was not referring to, as Donald Trump often would say on the campaign trail, that the system was rigged. The system that we elect our candidates by, where voters here in New York or Connecticut or New Hampshire, those primary processes are managed by the state government. We do, as a party, manage the caucuses and work it in collaboration with our state parties. But I wanted to make sure that everyone understood that Hillary won the primary fair and square. She not only received 4 million more votes than Senator Sanders, the majority of elected delegates, 9 out of 10 African Americans voted for her. She won 3 out of 4 contests. Bernie ran a fantastic campaign. It energized the party. He brought new people into the process. He participated as a Democrat throughout the primary and the general election. I believe that Bernie and many of his supporters and many of them are my colleagues on the DNC, they did a fantastic job overall in trying to heal the party post-convention, and it was my duty and obligation as the chair of the party, as I state in the book. My duty and responsibility was to go back and take an internal look, a forensic examination, and to ensure that no one ever takes over the party functions, any functions ever again during a primary. Mm.
So, listeners, your calls for Donna Brazil are welcome about her book or about yesterday's election results or the future of the Democratic Party going into 2018 and beyond. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So the big thing you found was this financial arrangement, as you've been saying, where the Clinton campaign, which was flush, was helping to fund the DNC, which was in debt, and the Clinton campaign had lots of control over the party's actions. So I want to ask you, why is that bad? Because I know Clinton loyalists who are saying, so what? Because if the Democratic Party thought its best chance at winning the election was to favor Clinton over Sanders in the primaries, the party is actually doing its job, because its job is to win the presidency, not to be mindlessly neutral. Do you buy that argument at all?
Look, as an officer and an activist in the Democratic Party, I do believe that the independence of the DNC was jeopardized, and that was wrong. And the word I used was cancer, because you don't take over any functions of the party prior to securing the nomination. I found no evidence. I mean, the communications department, the person that was hired, did not go out there and speak on radio or television on behalf of the Clinton campaign. The research department primarily focused on Donald Trump and the Republicans and getting ready for the fall campaign. Technology began to upgrade our system. But look, this was even before we knew that the DNC was being hacked by the Russians. And that department and the resources that the Clinton campaign eventually did provide was enable us to do remediation once we found out. So in the book, I stipulate that while it was not illegal, I found it unethical to put the party in that position. I have to applaud the staff who signed the agreement, because they made sure that none of the resources went into the states prior to the primary being over, or that none of the money was spent or used to advance one candidate over the other. My job as party chair was to go in and make an assessment, and I did that by bringing in somebody who worked with Howard Dean in 2004, who knew a lot about these joint fundraising agreements, and I brought in others inside the party who could help me ensure that the DNC was functioning properly once I became chair.
Judith in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Donna Brazil. Hi, Judith.
Hi, how you doing? And this is what I would say. I really respect Donna Brazil. I've looked up to you since you first, appeared on the scene with Al Gore. But I have to tell you, I am really disappointed that this stuff is being brought up at this time. So I'm going to ask you, what is it that you think ought to be done at this time to unify the party? And, look, Bernie's not even a Democrat, okay? He is an independent. So I just am bewildered that we are squandering the opportunities that we have at this time to really take back the House and the Senate. I mean, I just think that the timing of all of this discussion, we should not be relitigating what happened in 2016. That's my position. I'll take your answer off the air.
Judith, thank you so much.
And thank you, Judith, for all that you do and others do to not only help elect Democratic candidates but protect our democracy. You know, I've been told that this is the wrong time to tell troubling truths. Imagine if this book came out next year before the midterm elections or the year after when the 2020 cycle will begin. The year after a presidential election, in my view, is the best year for debate and dissent. I had to relive what I experienced in the hope that nobody else has to experience it again. I am a party, faithful to the party. I started at the age of 9. There's probably no one on the battlefield today that has spent more time in the trenches all across this country. 49 states, 7 presidential campaigns, 56 congressional campaigns. I didn't come on the scene with Al Gore. I became campaign manager because I was out there in 98. I was out there in 96. Go all the way back to 1976. That's who I am. This was a wound in our party. And the only way that you heal an open wound is to address it. We need to discuss what happened, all of it, so that we can heal and unite and move forward stronger. I respect those who believe that it was inappropriate, perhaps, to raise this. But if we don't change it, if the party cannot function by changing its the way it behaves, then we're going to, these doubts will be raised again. I want to say one thing on behalf of Tom Perez and the new leadership of the Democratic Party, including Michael Blake here from New York and many, many others, Grace Meng also from New York. They are making changes. The Unity Commission is comprised of both Sanders and Clinton delegates. And while Bernie is going to run as an independent and next year in his reelection, let me say that many of the people who came on board, they are Democrats. They are lifelong Democrats. They got as much skin in the game as I've had in the game. I respect their voices. I respect their participation. This is not about Bernie versus Hillary versus Martin versus Joe versus anyone else. This is about the future of our country. And if we're not able to have a conversation about what happened, then I'm afraid that we will make this mistake again. I got to add one more thing, Brian.
Yep.
But you know, I'm a fighter. Last night, I was so proud. I was proud. I was proud not just of the people here in New York who came out, New Jersey who came out. I was proud of the people in Virginia who went out and rain. I was proud of people in Maine, North Carolina, Georgia, all of the places we flipped last night. I'm proud of the grassroots Democrats who are going to help this party come out of the wilderness. Last night, the victory belongs to the grassroots Democrats.
So you're trying to unify everybody, obviously, but you keep using this strong language that is leaving people feeling divided, like it's a cancer, like what you found broke your heart. Even chapter 12 of your book, you compare your treatment by the Clinton campaign to Patsy the Slave from 12 Years a Slave. Because you're African American, that suggests to people's minds, at least, a racial component. Did you mean it that way?
Let me say this. On August 19, Donald Trump went into a black church in a black neighborhood, and he said, "What the hell do you have to lose?" I don't know if you recall that.
I do. He said it
and
a lot.
And for me, I'm sitting in my office in Washington, D.C., and I'm like, uh-oh, he is trying to divide the black vote. Now, by the way, I didn't know at that time that Facebook and Twitter and everybody else had black activists and others stoking the flame, so to speak. But at that moment, I'm like, I got to respond. The party needs to respond. I don't care if I'm black, white, blue, green, or purple, but I wanted to respond. And when I was told to sit down and not respond, I said, well, at least I could write a column. You can't take away my voice. I could not spend money that I felt the DNC was raising. The DNC had money. I wanted to spend it. And when I was told that all I could spend was $2 million, not the $8 million that I wanted, I rebelled.
Why didn't
they? Yes, I rebelled. And so I call that chapter, Brian. It's a little bit, look, you ever heard the words, the two words, tough love? It's tough love. I wanted to respond, because, and it's all in my book, and I hope people will read it, because there's a lot of good lessons to be learned. I responded by going out and raising money. I responded by going out and recruiting more people to help us. I responded by encouraging those who could spend their money to raise more money for the Democratic Party to fight back.
What?
This party is coming back, and it's coming back stronger for 2018, 2020, and beyond.
Why didn't they want you to respond to that?
Because they felt as though they had a better way of dealing with it. Remember, this was their campaign. I was not managing Secretary Clinton's campaign. I supported her campaign. I wanted to help her. That's why I became chair. I became chair because I wanted to help her win. This was the second time I have become chair of the party. I often tell my friend I am not the person they call on to manage things, but I'm always the person they call on to clean up the mess. And so I wanted her to win. I wanted her to win as much as I wanted Barack Obama to win in the fall of 2008. And I was putting everything I had on the table. And I got frustrated and disappointed that my friends felt as though they had to control the resources that I thought it should properly have been in the purview of the DNC. The DNC is an independent entity, independent of the candidates and the campaigns who are quote-unquote running. And I felt, as someone who has put my name on a lot of loan agreements and a lot of paper to raise money for the Democratic Party, that I should have had a say in how the money was spent.
Michelle in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Donna Brazil. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Brian.
Michelle.
Hi, Donna. So I'm a black woman. I was a Bernie Sanders supporter. And Donna, I think I'm so, like, excited in some ways that we're having this conversation, but there are some things that are really painful and I think need to be discussed and really can't be reconciled within this sort of narrative about the funding agreement, which is primarily the issue of the questions, right? Before these town halls in March of 2016, these two questions were sent, or, you know, the question about the death penalty and Flint were essentially sent to Ms. Clinton beforehand. And within this larger narrative of, like, what happened after you became chair of the DNC, it still seems to me that you participated in this coronation of Hillary, that, like, we Democrats were completely denied a primary. I mean, say what we will about Donald Trump, but, like, 16 people stood on that stage and battled it out through 9 debates till the end. And in our case, you know, we had 3 candidates, one of whom never had a shot. And the person that did have a shot, essentially things were stacked and created in his way and stacked against him from the very beginning. So I'm happy we're having this conversation. I think we need to have this conversation to move forward. But I think it's really, really difficult for me to hear some of what you're saying in light of the fact that you participated at the very onset in essentially propping up Ms. Clinton without, you know, like, it just, I mean, someone, one person's going into the debate and knows the questions they're going to be asked. And I also thought it was interesting.
First of all, ma'am, I'm glad you raised that, because I addressed that in my book. And long before I wrote a book, I addressed it millions of times. I'm probably the only American who had his or her emails hacked that went out to explain what was hacked. Being hacked is a theft. And while we know who stole our emails and created this discord and weaponized them, no one has been brought to justice. In my book, I addressed that. I worked as a commentator for CNN. I was also vice chair of the party. And in both capacities, in the book, I explain it all, and I like to make it very plain and very clear so that it's in black and white. I said that throughout that time, when we were trying to expand the number of debates, remember the DNC had announced that they will host only 6 debates. Well, I was one of those DNC officers that moved to get more debates. And, of course, being with CNN, I also moved because CNN was willing to host those additional debates, town hall forums, and much, much more. And I said in the book, and I finally got a chance to be able to tell my truth in my book, where I explain everything about those so-called debate questions at the forums, town hall, et cetera. Here's the one thing I know, and you can call Bernie Sanders and you can find out, and Martin O'Malley and the rest. I talked to all of the candidates. And while only the emails that were so-called leaked about Hillary Clinton came out through WikiLeaks and Guccifer 2.0 and DC Leaks, et cetera, I talked to everyone. I made sure that they were aware, so they were not blindsided by what we were trying to do, that these difficult issues that we had not addressed in previous debates would be brought up in Flint, in Columbus, where we had the town hall forum. And so I apologize later for having what I said, some of my emails leaked so that you could not see others. But, you know, I was an activist. I was trying to get more debates. I was trying to get more things out there. It's not as if CNN wrote the questions and gave them to me. It's Donna Brazil doing what Donna Brazil enjoy doing, which is stirring it up and getting these topics to the candidates. And then one thing I need to tell you, Brian, every week before I went on ABC or CNN, I would get my topics, and if they involve the Republicans, I call them and say, guess what? I'm going to talk about your primary. I'm going to talk about Jeb Bush or, you know, Governor Walker, Governor Christie. I need to know what your thinking is. I need to give you heads up. And that's what I did. And, again, I apologize because guess what? Once those emails went out, they were not my emails. They were John Podesta's. I couldn't confirm I couldn't verify if it was really John's email. John wasn't verifying it. But yet I had to explain to the American people, and Megyn Kelly and many others went after me, that the emails that were being leaked and weaponized were emails that belonged to me. I had no verification because my server, my DNC material was hacked. It was stolen. It was wiped clean. So I couldn't show, well, see, I gave this one to Bernie. I gave this one to Martin. I gave this to Jeb Bush. I gave this to Ted Cruz. So you know what I did as a good Catholic girl? I said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry because I cannot have something restored that was hacked.
But you're saying now you routinely gave questions or topics to people you were going to interview or be involved in debates with to have the most informed possible conversations. That's what you're saying.
Brian, at the time, I mean, I had to go back and let me tell you, I went back and I found emails between me and my bosses at CNN. I found emails between me and Roland Martin. I found emails between me and various other people in the Sanders campaign, the Clinton campaign. But when people came to me that night, I was in Georgia, and said, Donald, what about this email? I'm like, wait a minute, guys, I don't have it. I got to go home. I went standby, flew back to D.C., believing that maybe he's on my home machine. I had no reason to lie, because I knew what the truth was. But I could not produce any evidence of it, and that frustrated me. And it really made me sad. I mean, I talk about how sad I was because my integrity was at stake. I knew what I had done, and I knew Bernie well enough to know that he understood what I had done. I knew Hillary well enough to know that she understood what I had done, but I also knew what I had done. I knew as a Democratic Party operative who expanded the number of debates, who disbanded the town hall in form, at least I was an advocate for that. Black Lives Matter, people probably forgot about Black Lives Matter, but last year they were active. They wanted us to address these issues, and I did not want them to shut down another Democratic Party event because they feared that these questions would not be raised. And so I took it upon myself and working with diverse voices within the party to push these issues along. And again, it's not pretty when you're hacked. And the purpose of also writing this book, let me just put this out here. We were hacked. We were hacked by a foreign government who intended to hurt one of our candidates. That candidate happened to be Hillary Clinton. We were hacked, and it weakened our democracy at a time when we were in a very close election season. And most of the hack and most of the emails were aimed to try to sow discord within the Democratic Party, to destroy Hillary Clinton, to destroy the Democratic Party. And the other half of my book, we've talked about the first 10 chapters, Brian, but the other half of my book, and I hope your readers get a copy, it talks about what the Russians did to us and disseminating false information and creating this false narrative. And yes, I also believe that they propped up Donald Trump. And the media needs to take an examination of what they did and what they failed to do. Because last year I stopped talking to the press because all they wanted to talk about was those damn emails and not talked about the hacking, the harassment, and what we were going through as Democrats in our great country. We were attacked.
We have a few minutes left with Donna Brazile, whose new book is called Hacks: The Inside Story of the Break-Ins and Breakdowns That Put Donald Trump in the White House. Have you come to a conclusion for yourself about whether, without the Russian meddling, Hillary Clinton would have won?
You know, I think there are several different scenarios, but I do believe that the interference and the meddling caused us great harm in our country, and I'll tell you two reasons. One, the Russians just didn't go in and steal our emails and make us all look like fools. I mean, putting out somebody's recipe. The Russians interfere with our database. They harass and intimidated our donors. They harass and what I like to often say, they also infiltrate upgraded some of our voting systems, our e-poll books, voter registration systems. So I think the jury is still out. I am waiting for Bob Mueller and the congressional investigators. If you want to know how I really feel, go back and look at all of my columns. I have been focused on what happened on Election Day since I left the DNC. I have never experienced an election. Remember, I have the experience of Campaign 2000 when we had the hanging chads and the swinging chads and all the mother pregnant chads. This was a
and you won the country. You won the popular vote that time too.
Well, no, I know. I tell people I'm the Ernie Banks of politics. I have great statistics, but no championships. And I do have a lot of championships. But I'm back up at Harvard to figure out how to strengthen our democracy, how to restore faith in our democratic institutions, how to ensure that the Russians will not do to us in 2016 and 2018. I've been studying what happened in Germany and some of the other European countries. I'm working with Democrats and Republicans to come up with various tactics and techniques to train staffers so that we don't go through this again. And let me just say this. I am grateful once again to all of your listeners who not just supported Hillary or Bernie or whoever, but those who got out and voted last year. You're the hope of our country. You're the future of our country. And I want to encourage more young people to take their seats at the table. Yesterday was a great day. I feel like James Brown when he was singing, I feel good. I feel good that Democrats are coming back out of the wilderness.
Before we run out of time in about 2 minutes, I'm struck by two things about yesterday that aren't being talked about that much. Besides the governor races, 15 seats changing red to blue in the Virginia legislature, and the referendum in Maine, where people voted to join the Obamacare Medicaid expansion, which their Republican governor had declined to do. What do those two things tell you? And I saw Nicholas Kristof on TV last night, the New York Times columnist, suggest that Democrats get all kinds of progressive referenda up there for 2018, abortion rights, health care, assault weapons, to generate even more turnout. Like that idea?
I love that idea. You know, last night was one of those moments in my life when I just sit back and smile. This was not a victory of the top down. This was a victory of the bottom up. This is the bottom up. This is what grassroots politics is all about. People taking control of their own lives, going to the ballot box and saying, this is what I want. This is what we need. That's the power of the vote. That's the power of having people get out and participate. Brian, a few weeks ago, remember, I'm no longer the chair of the Democratic Party. I'm just an ordinary citizen, and yep, I care about my party, I care about my country, but a couple of weeks ago, I found myself in Northern Virginia. I'm like, I woke up, I'm like, what the hell am I doing? I'm 57 years old, I should be, you know, whatever. And I went out to Northern Virginia, and I was campaigning for a woman named Kathy Tran. Now, she was a great candidate, Asian American, and she wanted me to come out, and I said, yeah, I'll come out and do some canvassing. I did some canvassing, you know, another day for some other candidates. I went out to help Justin Fairfax. She won last night. She became the first Asian American ever to serve in the Virginia House of Delegates. Let me tell you something. There are days when we throw a little rock in the water and all of a sudden it has a ripple effect. These grassroots Democrats, the energy that you're seeing out there, that is not that energy will not only save the Democratic Party, it's going to save the United States of America. So I want to tell everybody who's out there, keep on keeping on because you are going to change America.
And we leave it there with Donna Brazile.
Hacks, buy the book, is great.
Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. Donna Brazile, thank you so much for coming on with us.
Always a pleasure talking to you, and thank you to all your listeners.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. 100 years ago today, women woke up in New York State with the right to vote for the first time. 1 year ago today, America elected the admitted sexual assaulter in chief. Of course, he didn't really admit it. He more like bragged about it to Billy Bush. Then there was all the race and religion baiting, the threat that there would be riots if he lost, and all the rest. And then came the last year that we have all endured. About a third of the country thinks this is all for the good. It's a lot less than a third here in greater New York. So on this election day 2017, you could be forgiven for experiencing some anniversary grief over election day 2016, the world you were expecting versus the world you got. One of the most important voices in America for starting to help non-Trump voters deal with the shock and grief was CNN commentator and former Obama Green Jobs official Van Jones. Remember this on CNN or maybe on your Twitter or other social media feed the next day? It came late on election night as the reality of the result began to sink in. 1 minute of Van Jones.
It's hard to be a parent tonight for a lot of us. You tell your kids, don't be a bully. You tell your kids, don't be a bigot. You tell your kids, do your homework and be prepared. And then you have this outcome, and you have people putting children to bed tonight, and they're afraid of breakfast. They're afraid of, how do I explain this to my children? I have Muslim friends who are texting me tonight saying, should I leave the country? I have families of immigrants that are terrified tonight. This was many things. This was a rebellion against the elites. True, it was a complete reinvention of politics and polls, it's true. But it was also something else. We've talked about race. I mean, we've talked about everything but race tonight. We've talked about income, we've talked about class, we've talked about region. We haven't talked about race. This was a white lash. This was a white lash against a changing country. It was a white lash against a black president in part. And that's the part where the pain comes.
Van Jones on CNN on election night. Since then, he's gone on to connect with all kinds of voters for his series of reports called The Messy Truth. And we are so glad he can join us to be a voice of reason, reconciliation, and hope, not just outrage, here on Election Day 2017. He has a new book called Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. The book includes an open letter to conservatives and an open letter to liberals and goes forward from there. Van, you are just who so many of our listeners would love to hear from today. So thanks for giving us some time. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, I'm glad to be on, and, you know, this is it's been a tough year, but we'll see how today goes.
Can you look back to election night first? Do you remember how much you thought a Clinton victory was pretty much a fait accompli, and how you felt when you saw what was actually happening?
Well, you know, I did not think that it was a fait accompli. I've been one of the few progressives that have been warning, really starting in June. I posted a piece, a video piece through MoveOn.org, explaining why Trump's victory was highly likely, and that a lot of the things we were holding on to, oh, he's going to have, you know, these gaffes are going to kill him, the demographics are going to save us. I debunked all that stuff, and I got every state right except for Wisconsin back in June. So, you know, everybody, it was kind of a roller coaster from going forward. I thought that that tape that released might have hurt him more than it did, but I wasn't completely surprised. And I think that part of where the real pain for a lot of liberals and progressives comes, if you're honest, most of us, as much as we spent the past year upset, we didn't really fight as hard as we might have last year. And I think it's important for us to remember that. It's not, 2008, people killed themselves for that election. And 2012, people did everything they could. They went to swing states. I didn't see that same fight in 2016. We fought harder to stop Mitt Romney than we did to stop Donald Trump.
You really think?
How many people do you know that left school, that went to swing states? And I don't know if you remember 2008 the way I remember it, but I remember it was almost a national obsession to elect Barack Obama. And it wasn't just about tweeting or Facebook posting or being upset or offended. It was about the hard work and knocking on doors and raising money. And I think we got away from that a little bit because people kept saying Donald Trump can't possibly win. And I think that we almost talked ourselves out of a victory. We should have been saying Donald Trump could win, and if he does win, it's going to be terrible. Let's work five times as hard as we did to stop Mitt Romney. But that was not the message from the Democrats.
Listeners, we can take a few phone calls for Van Jones, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You acknowledge in the book that many Trump voters deeply resented the word white lash in what you said on CNN that night because they heard it as painting them all unfairly as racists. In fact, you call that chapter of the book White Lash, Myths and Facts. And that's so admirable that you would take that kind of balanced approach to your own most heartfelt belief, maybe your own, greatest hit moment. But take our listeners there. What are some White Lash myths that you write about?
Well, I think that Liberals and progressives felt a lot of comfort by what I said that night because I was one of the few people who was willing to speak to the racial dimension of the Trump victory. I also that night was trying to point out, but it didn't get as much attention, that wasn't the only factor here. So I think, you know, I talk about the messy truth. In fact, my book is called Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart and How We Came Together, because the truth is messy. It is undeniable that there was a racial dimension there. In fact, you had, you know, Nazis and KKK people, an active part of the Trump coalition. But just because every Nazi voted for Trump does not mean every Trump voter is a Nazi. And in fact, far from it. There was you had 60 million people that voted, and they voted for many different reasons. And I think that liberals and progressives have done ourselves a disservice by painting every Trump voter with the same brush as, you know, the worst of his coalition. I think we wind up giving him voters he doesn't deserve. I don't think he deserves 60 million votes. I don't think he deserves 6 million votes. I don't think he deserves 6 votes. I don't think the Trump family should have voted for him. And I think every day that goes forward where we don't reach out and try to find some common ground and make it harder for him to keep his coalition together is a day that brings us closer to him being reelected possibly. And I don't want that to happen.
I was really struck by how you define white lash in the book, and you actually give it a dictionary-type definition, less in terms of hate or persistent Civil War mentality or anything like that, but in economic terms. I'll read your definition to everybody. A militant backlash powered by white working-class voters against both the economic and cultural consequences of neoliberal economic policy. Wow, why do you land on neoliberal economic policy? And for people who are scratching their heads, what does that even mean?
Well, it means, the bipartisan obsession with globalization that started in the 1990s and became, fashionable. The elite at the top of both parties said, hey, you know, we can pass these trade bills. Everything is going to be great for everybody. We can deregulate the banks. You know, let's go for it. Why do we have to stick up for the unions anymore? And as a result, from the perspective of some white workers, and I'd say white workers because, African-American, Latino, and Asian workers overwhelmingly oppose this kind of policy, the Trump kind of policy, but there's a big chunk of white workers, and not just in the United States, across the West, who looked at those neoliberal trade policies, deregulation, they looked at their lives and they said, hold on a second, all that has happened is that we are taking my job and sending it to foreign countries, and people from foreign countries are coming here, and I don't see how I'm benefited by either dynamic. So I have both an economic and a cultural reaction, an economic and a racial reaction against the whole project. And that is, something that, I call the core of that, especially like the most militant core of that. That's that white lash element. And it is, it's important. It is messy because it is economics and it is cultural. And people say, if it's cultural, that means it's racist. If it's racist, we don't have to deal with it. No, that's not right because, change is hard for people. Look at an African-American neighborhood that's gentrifying. We recognize, change is hard when a community begins to flip in that way. Change is hard for some white communities when they see those kind of changes. That doesn't mean we back off immigration. That doesn't mean we apologize, or bow down to racism. But it just says there's got to be some sense of empathy when you have communities that are going through change that they didn't choose for themselves. The only thing you say to those communities is you're a racist. And we don't say, we need you, and here's how you can be a part of our coalition, and here's what you get by being a part of our coalition, and here's the respect you get, not just the policies, but the respect and the inclusion, then it's hard for me to understand how we're supposed to tell people, you are a racist bigot for voting for Donald Trump, now vote for me. We're missing a part of the argument when we do that, and that's part of what the book is about.
My guest is political activist and CNN commentator Van Jones. His new book is Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. And Elisa in Harlem, you're on WNYC with Van Jones. Hi, Elisa.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. Mr. Jones, I'm a huge fan of your work, and you have an integrity to talk about this that few people do after the way you were treated when you were the Green Job Czar. A lot of women I know feel really forgotten in this last election, and the way that sexism has been ignored in the discussion of the 2016 campaign, and I was wondering if you could comment on that.
I think that there's a very strong point there, and I may be guilty of that myself at times. You know, when I went to red states and red counties after the election, and actually even before the election, I did hear right alongside the Islamophobia, right alongside a lot of the racially negative attitudes, I did hear a lot of sexism. I heard even some women in red counties saying that, you know, they didn't think we were ready to have a female president. And I think it's something that I appreciate you raising. I think this kind of a Harvey Weinstein moment or whatever is maybe going to help people do a better job on that. But I think you're right, and I appreciate you raising it.
To that point further, I think, Clarence in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Clarence.
How you doing? My argument is that we talked about this over 30 years ago with Jesse Jackson, that but if these companies were going to leave, give people 6 months to a year's notice and retrain them, didn't want to talk about it. And they were sold white privilege, white male privilege at the time, and white women went along with it. White people, and especially the white working class, did this to themselves. And they are now trying to blame black people. They're trying to blame Latinos. They're trying to blame women for what happened to them. I say that let's take the gloves off. They don't want the political correctness, and so let's talk, but don't hold back.
Van, talk to Clarence.
Well, I remember the 1980s and the Rainbow Coalition and Reverend Jackson's great work in trying to pull people together and to point out that, you know, the family farms being stolen by these big agribusinesses and all this sort of, you know, bad corporate behavior meant that poor black folk and poor white folk and poor Latinos, poor Native Americans, poor Asians and poor folk in general and working folk in general had much more in common than the media was telling us, and that, you know, common pain should lead to common purpose. That's basically my point, and that's where I'm coming from. I agree with you that, you know, there have been people who ignored those arguments and have bought into bad arguments, you know, blaming folks who don't have any power for their peril. That said, I don't think just taking the gloves off and, which I don't know if you meant, but in taking the gloves off and kind of, you know, fighting them over their you know, misunderstanding situation is enough. I mean, I don't think now we lack for a left or a progressive movement or a women's movement or, you know, Black Lives Matter, whatever, that lacks in self-confidence or militancy. I think the Women's March and Black Lives Matter and the Dreamers are showing, you know, the world that, you know, human rights matter here and we'll fight for them. All I'm saying is that in addition to fighting against the worst in the white working class, we should also be fighting for the best in the white working class. Because, you know, at its best, the white working class as a part of the labor movement, you know, serving in the military, doing a lot of the tough work that's made the country great, at its best is an invaluable ally for progress. And I think sometimes we forget that. A lot of times when I hear liberals and progressives talk now about, quote unquote, straight white guys or straight white Christian guys in the red states, it's almost like they're talking about an enemy and not a part of the working class, or not a part of folks who are struggling, folks who are hurting, folks who may have bad ideas, but just because you got bad ideas doesn't make you bad people. You know, I spend a lot of my time going into prisons, and I get a chance to work with some of the, you know, smartest, most amazing people behind bars. Some of them have done things I would argue are perhaps worse than voting for Donald Trump, but I don't write them off and say that, you know, because of, you know, what you did in the past, I'm only going to judge you based on that. And I think we should extend that same basic liberal progressive sense of grace and dignity and decency and open-heartedness to not to Donald Trump himself. Donald Trump himself is a nightmare and a threat to the country. But to people who voted for Donald Trump, for whatever reason that they did, I think that we make it too easy for Trump to keep those people if we don't have something to say to them besides that we're mad at them about their vote. We can be mad at them about their vote, but still be passionate that they deserve better jobs, better health care, clean air, clean water, and that we need them, that we want them to be a part of the country that we're trying to build, and that country will be better for them as well as for us.
We have a few minutes left. We're going to have Donna Brazile on the show tomorrow. Obviously, you know her from Democratic Party politics and from CNN.
I know her, and I love her.
And so I'm curious, how much are the bombshells about the Clinton campaign and the DNC in her new book related to what you're talking about?
Listen, I love Donna Brazile. I want to say that loud and clear. If I could just say that for the next hour, I would do it. People do not want, you know, people always say, you know, the truth will set you free, but it's going to make you mad first. And the reality is, until we bring the sunshine, the cleansing sunshine, into the Democratic Party, I talk in my book about, you know, whole states of people where African American and Latino frontline activists were begging the Democratic Party and begging the Clinton campaign for investment and support, because they could see that they were losing, that we did not have the ability to produce the kind of turnout that we needed for Clinton that we had for Obama. And all of those people were told no. Latinos ran out of money registering voters. Forget turning out voters. Registering voters in Florida, and couldn't get more money. And so there's a lot that went on inside that party that people don't want discussed. I am proud of Donna Brazile for raising it. People, well, don't raise it now. Well, when are we going to raise it? Because, you know, tomorrow always comes. And if the same people with the same bad ideas, the same contempt for grassroots activism, the same greed for money for consultants are not challenged now, then when 2020 comes, they'll still be doing the same thing, and we'll have 8 years of Donald Trump. I love Donna Brazile. I'm proud of what she did. I hope that more people will speak out, because it's only when we have honesty and tell the truth, even when it's messy, that we're going to have progress.
One of her things was that the egos of Clinton, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and Obama help contribute to the decimation of Democratic control nationwide, like the same stats you cite in the book, down from 29 governors in 2008 to 16 today, and loss of about 1,000 state legislature seats across the country since Obama was elected. Do you think President Obama, through neglect or some other way, contributed to that?
President Obama became the captain of the Titanic after it hit the iceberg. In other words, you know, the two bad wars that was before him, and the big crash. And so when he came in, he had a Herculean effort to put the economy back on track, to pass health care, to do the stuff that he did with no help and no partnership. I think all of us got in that Obama bubble bath for about 8 years, and all of us were kind of like, hey, this feels really good. And then when it was time to fight, we stood up, we were wet and wrinkly, and we weren't ready. And, you know, I'll put myself in that blame pit, as, you know, as well as Obama and everybody else. But we've got to get past this thing where everybody, you know, whose last name is Obama or Clinton or Biden or whatever, are kind of above criticism because we're in this fight with Trump. Everybody needs to sit around the table, sit around the campfire, figure out what we could have done better. Nobody's perfect. I admire the Obamas for what they did. Our head, shoulders, knees, and toes above every other first family. And there were things that looking back, could have been done better, and I'm glad that Donna Brazile is willing to point that out.
The Obama bubble bath is a term I never thought I'd hear on this show, but we just heard it from Van Jones, whose new book is Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. People love you. Keep talking to us, okay?
Hey, please. I'd love to. Thank you.
I will tell you where to go. Everywhere leads to everywhere in Lagos. Don't be afraid of getting lost.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and you've heard of Hollywood and Bollywood. Are you ready for Nollywood? The Nigerian movie industry actually produces more features than the one in California, and what started as a low-cost way to fill video cassettes with entertainment is becoming a full-fledged creative and financial powerhouse. Some call the transformation gentrification. Emily Witt, a Brooklyn-based journalist, took a trip to Nigeria to study this moment of transformation, and her book, Nollywood, The Making of a Film Empire, was just published as part of the Columbia Global Report series. She is joined here by Nigerian director Daniel Oriahi, whose Taxi Driver, it's not that Taxi Driver, is one of Nollywood's highest grossing films so far. Welcome both of you to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Are you part of the Nigerian diaspora and part of the global distribution chain, therefore, for Nollywood movies? What would you tell everybody else that makes Nollywood movies special, that should make them want to go see one? What's your favorite film? And you can also tell us how you watch Nollywood movies on disc, streaming, at a cinema. Call us up, 212-433-WNYC. If you watch Nollywood movies, 212-433-9692. Emily Witt, can you give us a sense of the size and scope of Nollywood today?
Sure. Nollywood consists of a couple of different strains of movies. In general, the industry produces around 1,500 movies a year, but many of those are very, very low budget, straight to video releases. And then there's more cinematic movies. About 200 of those come out every year, and that's a newer version of Nollywood.
And Daniel, I see your film Taxi Driver, available for streaming on Netflix, by the way, is about a guy who moves from the countryside to the big city of Lagos and finds he's inherited his late father's taxi cab. And that's a theme in a lot of Nollywood films, isn't it? How someone new to the city adapts to urban life and its dangers?
Yeah, because Nigeria is it's quite a small country, and we have very few cities that where you can have opportunities as an individual. And so there's always this constant rural urban migration that takes place. And I just tried to make a film that could focus on that kind of movement.
So does it consciously serve a sort of social acclimation purpose for people new to the city, in addition to whatever entertainment purpose?
Yeah. Yeah, yes.
But unlike some of the old school films, yours, I gather, is moodier and less of a morality tale, like in Taxi Driver, than some others?
Yeah. So for my film, I was partly influenced by Martin Scorsese while growing up in film school and all that. Yeah. So
you took the name of that film, Taxi Driver.
Yeah. And I wanted to celebrate the guy. And actually, we have a Nigerian name for it, which is in Yoruba. It means Oko Ashawo. Oko Ashawo is the slang that is given to taxi drivers because of their interactions with prostitutes and people of the night. And so that title resonated more with Nigerians. And yeah, basically that.
Let's take a phone call. Oh, I thought we had a phone call already. Can I go to Sadiq in East Orange? Yeah. Sadiq, you're on WNYC. Hi. Do we have?
Hi.
Hi there. You a Nollywood fan?
Yes, I am. I've been a Nollywood fan since I was a little kid. Yeah, maybe for more than 20 years.
Wow.
Are you from Nigeria originally?
Originally from Ghana.
Oh, oh wow. Good stuff.
Yeah. So I was talking about the impact Nollywood has that is like far beyond Nigeria. Yes. Nollywood has an impact all over West Africa and even maybe Africa in general. Yeah. It has contributed a lot to both economically, and maybe culturally. When you go to Ghanaian communities in the diaspora, Senegalese communities, and even when you go to, for example, when you go to Accra in Ghana, there are several stores which merchandise just Nigerian movies, and it is a job creation machine. So I just wanted to stress the fact that it has far-reaching implications beyond Nigeria.
Thank you so much for calling in. And let's go right to another call. Here is Sheena in Deer Park. You're on WNYC. Hi, Sheena.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. I see you have a favorite Nollywood movie.
Yes, it's Royal Palace.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh.
Talk about it.
Well, about the movie.
Yeah.
The movie, what I liked about the movie, over the period of time, I've watched a lot of Nigerian movies, and there have been a lot of emphasis on fetish things and so on and so forth. But that was the first movie that I actually saw had a theme plot, and we could move on from Royal Palace 1 to Royal Palace 2 and Royal Palace 3. And it actually flowed from one different theme to the other. And there was no, moreover, there was no emphasis on either anything fetish, but there was almost like a living Lion King movie.
Sheena,
so
there you go.
That's what I saw.
There's your thumbnail. All right. Very good. So there's an example. And I guess one of the things that came out here, Emily, from the first two callers is that this industry does have impact internationally. it's a Nigerian film industry, but people watch it in Ghana, people watch it elsewhere in Africa, and obviously people watch films from there here.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's so cool about Nollywood is it grew global in that way, really outside any traditional channel of capital or distribution. Those movies went global by people copying the videotapes and the video discs and driving them around Africa and passing them around and selling them. And now the industry is entering into more traditional channels of distribution like Netflix and like the cinema.
Dora in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dora.
Hi, how are you? Just wanted to say I'm Nigerian American, and just last month on Netflix, I saw Taxi, and I completely enjoyed it.
I thought
it was one of the best movies, Nollywood movies made. There's a joke amongst Nigerians that you can always tell a Nollywood movie. There's always a witch, there's always black magic, there's always the same soundtrack, there's always, you know, the characters never age, or if they age, they're always wearing the same clothing. So that's why Taxi, the movie, stood out. It was so well made. I think, quite frankly, the storyline was, it kept me in suspense. I'm Igbo, so I was able to enjoy hearing the Yoruba, the dialect, as well as just seeing how the characters evolved. So I just want to give you a shout out and say well done.
Thank you.
Also saw a short movie called Beriga Sugar that was just phenomenal as well. So I'm quite proud as a Nigerian to say Nollywood is here to stay. And I just say keep doing a great job. We're enjoying it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dora, thank you so much. There's a lot of English spoken in Nigeria, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So are these films in Yoruba, sometimes English, sometimes?
It's predominantly English. Why Taxi Driver was different was I was just trying to make a film that was primarily focused on the Yoruba. It was in the Yoruba space. So I don't even speak Yoruba. I come from the eastern part of Nigeria. Because I was making this film about people living in Lagos who speak predominantly Yoruba, I had to keep it in that language space and all that. And so English is actually like the primary, because a lot of filmmakers are trying to spread out their films so that they get more appeal and appreciation out there.
Emily, you touched sort of tangentially on what I think is a big problem, which is piracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of the revenue generated by a film ends up going to people other than the film's makers. And, you know, and the finances of the film, too. How big a problem is it?
It's a huge problem because somebody like Daniel will make a movie, it'll get a cinema release, but there's fewer than 30 movie theaters in Nigeria. Yeah. So the main way that people watch movies is on discs, and those audiences reach in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, but because the discs get pirated and copied, none of that money goes back to the people that made the movie.
I read that, maybe this was in your book, that Mark Zuckerberg paid a visit to Nollywood a year ago.
Yeah.
So, Daniel, is Facebook's interest a cause of concern or a celebration?
It is a celebration, because I think the whole online space is something that a lot of producers are actually very interested in because of curbing piracy as well. And I believe Zuckerberg was in the country basically because he was very interested in Nollywood being on the online space, because we have online platforms like Iroko TV, Netflix, that have currently picked up a lot of Nigerian films and are getting a lot of traction. And I think Zuckerberg is actually looking at that avenue as well. Yeah.
Yemi in West Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi there. Am I saying your name right? Is it Yemi?
It's Yemi.
Hi, Yemi. You there? Yemi once, Yemi twice. Busayo in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Busayo.
Hi, Brian. So what I find interesting, I'm Nigerian-American, and one thing I found interesting was I entered a cab, this was a few years ago, and the gentleman who was driving the cab is an Algerian man, and when he found out I was from Nigeria, he just exclaimed with joy because he said he loves Nigerian movies. You know, my Haitian hairstylist watches Nigerian films, a lot of Jamaican folks from the islands watch these movies, and you meet people from Mexico who also watch them, and I think that the key, the through line between all these sort of immigrants and their their connection with these films is that there's a certain, you know, certain kind of like village life, a certain kind of like familial connection, ways of kind of operating in the world that's very, very different than what you would see in Hollywood, that these kind of relationships are reminiscent oftentimes, and I'm making huge generalizations, but of what, you know, immigrants themselves left back home. And so I know that for my mother, she watches these movies on YouTube constantly, and it's sort of a way to kind of reconnect and stay connected to sort of like the way that societies in these non-Western countries are kind of constructed. And you never really see that in Hollywood, right? Like, you know, Jennifer Aniston doesn't necessarily represent these people's lives, you know, and in a way that they can connect to these Nigerian films in a way that they maybe can't to a lot of what Hollywood is producing. And I watched mine on Netflix. And my favorite director is a gentleman called Kunle Apolayo, and I really love his work.
Yeah, I think the whole Nollywood fascination is the fact that you have a lot of, it's kind of like an expose on the Nigerian condition, which is clearly articulated by the Nigerian audience and Africans in diaspora as against what Hollywood had been creating over the years. So I think that has been a strong interest for viewers all over the place. And we, as filmmakers, we are influenced by our immediate environment. So there's no way we're going to make movies, be it in any genre, which wouldn't have a reflection of our immediate environment, which is Nigeria.
Busayo, thanks. Now, I see there's a screening of your film, Taxi Driver, at Barnard College tonight, sponsored by Columbia's Institute of African Studies. Listeners, we have a link for reservations on our show page. Since this is at Barnard, what do you want the academic world to know about your film and Nollywood in general?
I think it's the same idea of what it takes to make an industry, the drive of independent individuals just trying to create content, be it escapism, because that's what it was at first. It was escapism, but now it's becoming more of a cultural phenomenon because, like I said, it's that expose on the Nigerian individual, the identity. And that's one thing I have been so attracted to in Nollywood, because Nigeria is a small country developing and all that. So we're still trying to find our history, but Nollywood has been able to stand us out and giving us an identity. And I think every Nigerian, be it in Nigeria or in diaspora, should associate with that because it's something proud of.
And Emily, for your book, to get your immersion in Nollywood films, I see you visited a wholesale market in Lagos and got copies of several films. If someone here wanted to get a similar education, where should they start?
Well, Iroko TV is a great place to start. It's a subscription service like Netflix. You pay a fee every month and you have access to thousands of movies. That's a great place. Or even just to go on YouTube and go around. Yeah.
Get one more caller in here. I think Yemi in West Harlem is back. Hi, Yemi.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much. My call got cut off the last time. I just wanted to talk of my favorite film, which is called The Wedding Party. I think it's brilliant for anyone that wants to watch their first Nollywood film. The Wedding Party is a great, great film to watch. It's actually on Netflix. It's funny, it's sad, it's romantic. It shows Lagos in a brilliant light. As a wedding designer, the topic, you know, was personal to me. The costumes are fantastic. It's just a brilliant film. That's what I wanted to say.
Emily, do you know that one?
I do know it. It's one of the highest grossing movies.
It is actually the highest grossing.
Yeah, in Nigerian cinema. And it's a great movie. It just celebrates the great tradition of the ostentatious Nigerian wedding. And it's a comedy. It has all the major stars of Nollywood in it. It's a big kind of lavish blockbuster.
My big fat Nigerian wedding.
Exactly.
Yeah actually. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, we are going to have to leave it there. Thank you to Emily Witt, author of Nollywood, The Making of a Film Empire, from the Columbia Global Report series, and to Nigerian director Daniel Oriahi. And again, you can watch, you can watch the trailer for Taxi Driver on our webpage, or you can screen it on Netflix, or reserve a seat to see it in person and hear a Q&A with Daniel tonight at Barnard and Columbia. And Emily will be talking about the book at the offices of N+1. Next Thursday in Dumbo. Check out any of those links on our webpage if you want to know more. Emily Witt, Daniel Oriahi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.